Today's Taisho will be on case 32 in the Heikigan Roku. Case 32 is entitled Jo-Joza Stands Still. Engo's introduction. Once the delusive way of thinking is cut off, a thousand eyes are suddenly opened. One word blocking the stream of thought and all Nen actions are controlled. Is there anyone who would undergo the experience of dying the same death and living the same life as the Buddha? Truth is manifest everywhere. If you do not see it, here is an ancient example. See the following. Main subject. Jo-Joza asked Rinzai, what is the essence of Buddhism? Rinzai, getting up from his seat, seized him, slapped him, and pushed him away. Jo-Joza stood still. A monk standing by said, Jo-Joza, why don't you bow? When Jo-Joza bowed, he suddenly became enlightened. Secho's verse, inheriting the spirit of Dansei, how could he be gentle and quiet? Not difficult for Kyore to lift his hands and split Mount Hesan, letting the Yellow River through. So I want to thank everybody for sitting so well this morning, sitting so still. Very inspiring to practice with people who are so committed and who practice wholeheartedly. Wholehearted practice. It's not easy to do anything wholeheartedly. And this is really part of what this koan is all about. And beyond that, it's a essential element of the teaching of the school that we're training in, the Linji or Rinzai School of Zen. So, just for the backstory here, Jo-Joza is a senior monk in a temple. Joza is like an elder, like an elder. So this is like Elder Jo stands still. So he's been in the temple for a long time, and he's had challenges because he hasn't had his great awakening experience. So maybe he came to the temple with other novices long ago, and they all left home and they shaved their heads. And they made big sacrifices, in traditional Buddhism, if you want to be a monk or a nun, you pretty much have to renounce all aspects of your former life. You leave your family, you don't marry, you don't have any personal property, you shave your head, you're given a new name. And then you basically turn your life over to the temple. And there's a kind of social contract there that after some period of time, you're going to have an enlightenment experience, right? That's what you're there for, to see your Buddha nature face to face. So Jo-Joza has done all of those things. He's given up everything for enlightenment. He's been at the temple, maybe all his Dharma brothers have gone through the training and had an awakening experience, and he's like left there, right? Sort of left there. And this is where he is. What a difficult place to be in. A number of years ago, I had a chance to talk to an old graduate school buddy of mine. He invited me to come out and speak at his University, which is out in Illinois. And I flew out there and I gave this talk, and afterward we hadn't seen each other in like 20 some years, maybe more. And he said, "It's so wonderful, I loved your talk." And he said, "You know, I was the last one of our cohort to get a job." So we had all started graduate school at the same time, and we had all gone through the process to get a PhD. And then we had gone, what's called in the academic world, you go out on the job market and you try to find a tenure track position at a university. And I wasn't the first person in our group to get one of those jobs. I didn't get one my first year out, but my second year out, I got one. Well, anyway, my friend, his name is Dana. Dana said I was the last person there. He finally got a job, a tenure track job. But he said it was a difficult place to be. He said, because not only did I not get the job I aspired to get, but all my friends were gone. They had all moved on. It's a very difficult place to be, you know. So anyway, Jojo Zha's like that, right? He's somebody who's been at the temple a long time. He's made all the sacrifices, and it hasn't happened for him. It hasn't happened. And so, you know, he basically, this question that he asks Rinzai is not just like a philosophical or speculative question. He says, "What is the essence of Buddhism?" And what he's really saying is, you know, I haven't got it. I haven't got it. You know, I haven't found it. And it's kind of odd for like this very senior monk ask this question. It's like, I've been practicing for 35 years and I still haven't found it. Rinzai, getting up from his seat, seized him, slapped him, and pushed him away. Jojo Zha stood still. A monk standing by said, "Jojo Zha, why don't you bow?" When Elder Joe bowed, he suddenly became enlightened. So that's the koan. You know, one of the key figures in this koan, aside from Elder Joe, is Rinzai, right? Linji Rinzai. And, you know, we practice our kind of Zen practice is called Linji or Rinzai Zen. And if you know anything about Zen, there's supposedly two major schools of Zen. There's actually like three. But there's supposedly two major schools of Zen, the Soto, the Tsao Tung, and the Linji. And these are, you know, basically Linji Zen often uses koans or always uses koans, and Soto Zen doesn't always use koans, right? Awareness of moment. So much is made of these differences, which I think are really very minor. But at any rate, we practice in the Linji tradition. And if you know anything about the history of Zen in China, you know, Zen began as this really marginal tradition of Buddhism in China. When Bodhidharma brought Zen, Tan, to China, he didn't meet with instant success, and for a long time, Zen was rather marginal school. Many other schools were represented at the capital, right, at the time, priests and nuns from various sects were in the imperial quarters, and Zen was sort of like out in the country. It was out in the countryside. So it stayed in a marginal position for a long time, but it eventually became the dominant form of Buddhism in China. And the dominant form of Zen was Linji Rinzai Zen. So, you know, the last imperial dynasty and the Republic of China with the Sun Yat-sen, if you have gone around China, almost every Buddhist temple would have called itself, or at least every Zen temple would have called itself a Rinzai temple. They would have said, yes, this is a Linji temple. So Linji Zen became this hugely important element of Chinese Buddhism. But, you know, and we practice in the Linji tradition, but it's like, what is the Linji tradition anyway? What is it? And if you say, well, it's about koans, that's true, but you're not getting to the heart of the tradition. You know, what is Rinzai Zen anyway? What's it about, you know? And if you decide to read the Linji Lu, the Rinzai Roku, the collection of Rinzai stories, you may not come away with any clear answer either. You know, if you see pictures of Rinzai, he's often represented as very fierce. So you'll see a picture of Rinzai, and he looks like a really tough customer. He looks has a fierce expression on his face, and his hands are clenched, and he looks frightening, not inviting at all. You know, so you could get this impression that Rinzai Zen is, you know, like joining the Marines or something. It's this terrible experience, right? And if you read the Rinzai Roku, it doesn't necessarily disabuse you of that impression, right? You know, Rinzai would go around slapping a lot of people and yelling at them, and it's like, oh my God, I don't want to be slapped, I don't want to be yelled at. And this is a very famous encounter, a very famous koan in the Linji Lu, the Rinzai Roku. Roku is like book or a collection of anecdotes. This is the third koan in the third entry in the Rinzai Roku. The master, that's Rinzai, ascended the hall and said, "Here in this lump of red flesh, there is a true person with no rank. Constantly he goes in and out of the gates of your face. If there are any of you who don't know this for a fact, then look, look." At that time, there was a monk who came forward and asked, "What's he like, this true person of no rank?" Rinzai got down from his chair, seized hold of the monk, and said, "Speak, speak." The monk was about to say something, whereupon the master let go of him, shoved him away, and said, "True person of no rank. Why, what a shitty ass wiper." The master then returned to his quarters. So if you read that, it's like, I don't know if I want to be involved in Rinzai Zen. You know, he doesn't seem, you know, somebody like Joshu seems so nice, you know, and Rinzai seems like a gigantic grouch, you know, at the very least. Is it like he'll beat you up or something? So it's easy to misunderstand what the fundamental teaching of Rinzai is. And I think that in Chinese culture, he translates a little differently than he does in our culture. You know, this idea, Rinzai says in his little talk is, you know, there inside you, going in and out of your body with every breath, is a true person of no rank. And even that doesn't make sense in our culture too much. But, you know, it's important to think about the fact that in Chinese culture, everybody had a rank, right? So China, luckily, never had anything like a caste system, which is truly a terrible system. But China was a gigantic bureaucratic state, and it was you had many levels and layers of authority, with the emperor at the top, and then you had various levels of imperial functionaries, you know, mandarins. And then you had this great mass of about 95% of the people in China were peasants, and about 5% were merchants.
Right.
So you had this very steep hierarchy. And, you know, everybody who wanted to be somebody trained up at least one of their sons to be a scholar. And to be a scholar meant that you were capable of taking the imperial exams. And if you took the imperial exams, you would be, if you did well, you would get an appointment, a government appointment, and you could rise up in the bureaucracy. And, you know, basically your whole family would benefit because you would be a big shot. You know, you could send business their way, you could make decisions that would influence your friends and your family's fortunes. So, you know, for a family that got a son into the bureaucratic system, it was like this great victory for the whole family. So everybody except the people who were at the top, felt lousy about themselves. You know, lots of Zen masters were imperial exam failures, people who took their imperial exams and didn't do well enough to get into the bureaucracy. The lots of Zen masters. But even, you know, everybody felt lousy because, you know, even if you did pass your exams and you did get an appointment in the imperial bureaucracy, it might not be a very high appointment. And even if it's a relatively high appointment, there's always somebody higher, see? So you know, I think what made Rinzai so, one of the things that made Rinzai so popular was that he understood how badly everybody felt about themselves, that the system pretty much guaranteed that everybody looked down on themselves and didn't respect themselves. So peasants in China could not read. That was true in Europe too, right? So if you couldn't read, you just hoped to get enough land to have a decent life, right? And if you could get to be an upper level peasant, that means you had a big farm and at least you'd be okay. But you know, even the peasants had ranks. There were wealthy peasants and dirt poor peasants, and so everybody pretty much felt lousy about themselves. And Rinzai comes along in this koan and he says, you know, in you there is a person of no rank. You know, outside of all of these standards and all of these hierarchies, in you there's this person who is fundamentally Buddha nature itself. You are fundamentally Buddha nature itself. And again he talks about having faith in your true nature. Have faith, trust your true nature. So, and again, you know, we might not understand what that really means. What does it mean to trust your true nature? So, you know, Zen itself can turn into a hierarchy, you know, in Japanese Zen, it's very much the case that in every temple there's a hierarchy, and you know, basically the roshi will wear clothes that identify him or her as the roshi, and it includes a beautiful brocaded rakusu or special brocade on the robe, right? And then, you know, there's a kind of ranking system in people's clothes. It's right out of Imperial China, actually, you know. In China, if you saw a bureaucrat, they had an emblem on their shirt, and you could tell what rank they were just from the emblem, right? So it's not so different. Not so different sometimes in the world of Zen, right? And so you know, basically, it's possible to turn Zen into another kind of competitive hierarchy, right? And it's possible to turn Zen into another occasion for you to feel lousy about yourself, like Jojo Zog. And you know, if you ask me what, well, I won't get to what I think is the essence of Rinzai Zen right now, but I want to at some point in the Taisho today. But let's just talk about failure in Zen. Because failure is pretty much guaranteed in Zen. I mean, maybe I shouldn't tell you that now, I should wait 20 years. but yes, failure is pretty much guaranteed in Zen. So, but it's actually guaranteed in everything, according to Rinzai, Linji. So look, let's say you decide you want to practice Buddhism, and you take a course on like mindfulness, right? And you go to a place that teaches mindfulness, and you decide you're going to be mindful. And the teacher will say, you know, focus on your breath. You know, try not to think thoughts, but just focus on your breath. So, you know, maybe you sit down on the cushion or you sit in your chair and you straighten your back and you breathe through the hara and you focus on the breath and you focus on the breath. And for a long time, it's a big struggle, right? You have all these thoughts. You know, if you're a beginner, you sit down on the cushion and you have all of these thoughts. It's so hard to get to the breath. And finally, you begin to get to the breath, right? Basically, the thoughts recede to the side and the breath is at the center of your attention. But, what's likely to, and you might think to yourself, I've finally done it. You know, I've finally done it. I have mindfulness of breath. Now, you know, what could happen to you right after that is that you start thinking again, and your breath becomes hard to get pay attention to. I don't know if that's ever happened to you, but that happened to me for many, many years. In fact, it still happens to me. You know, we have an idealization of what's supposed to happen, which is we have lots of thoughts and we move past the thoughts and we focus on the breath and we achieve one pointedness of breath. And indeed, that's what we achieve at some point. But then what, see? Then what? You know, it's inevitably the case that when you are able to achieve mindfulness of breath, that state is temporary. It's temporary. And after a while, thoughts are going to return. And, you know, you may or may not be able to push them away and return to the breath. But you know, when all of this is happening, you might get discouraged. You might say to yourself, oh, I can't believe it. You know, I've been practicing meditation. I've been trying to be mindful. I had that golden moment where I was one with my breath, see, and then the thoughts came back, and now I'm going backward again, see. This is quite common for people to think, you know. So now you keep practicing, and the teacher says, okay, I'd like you to focus on emptiness, mu xin. So, you know, you go to a few sashin and you really do the sitting, right? And you practice and you practice. And you watch the breath and the mind gets to be empty and you just keep going back into that emptiness, into that emptiness. And let's say, you know, it's day two of the sashin. You've been practicing and you sit down on the cushion and you just get into that emptiness. And then the bell rings and you get up and you go to the bathroom and you come back and you just can't get into the emptiness, or you get into the emptiness but you fall out of the emptiness. It's like, you know, why can't I just get into that emptiness and stay in that emptiness? Why can't I do that? And of course, you beat yourself up. You might say, I'm a Zen failure. I'm never going to succeed at this. Or you spend even more time on the cushion. You work really hard to stay in that emptiness, but I have to tell you the truth. Even if you were the Dalai Lama, when you enter that emptiness, you can't stay there. You can't stay there. And in fact, you know, you can get there. You can get to be in a place of, you can get into an emptiness that's so deep that time just disappears. And you don't even hear things. You can get into an incredibly deep samadhi of emptiness. You know, but sooner or later, you're going to come out of it. And there's actually a koan that deals with this. You know, it's more, I'm not going to tell you what the koan is, but basically the student working on the koan will go into deep mushin and then fall out. And deep, you go into deep mushin and you pop out again. And it's like, what the hell, right? I'm supposed to be able to get into that deep emptiness and stay there without interruption. And when you work on this particular koan, you immediately fall out and you're back in the zendo, and time, you know, it's, you know, you've got 20 minutes to sit and you feel disconnected from things. And it's like, when I did this koan, I got so mad I almost quit Zen, you know. When I realized I couldn't stay in emptiness, that I would keep falling out of emptiness, and that this wasn't, I was so mad, I remember just going into the Genki Roshi and I felt like saying, this is all bullshit. So I'm not trying to discourage anybody from practicing. On the contrary, you know, the truth is that if you try to become one with your breath and push your thoughts aside, you will have a victory. You will become one with your breath for a little while, and then the thoughts will come back. Or, well, another thing that can happen is you're watching the breath, and you're watching the breath, and you're watching the breath, and all of a sudden the breath is nowhere to be found. It actually disappears. So when you try to focus on the breath, your mind becomes empty, and the breath disappears. And when you try to focus on emptiness, thoughts return to your mind. So all of this is sort of like a nightmare, right? Sort of like a nightmare, if you're into Zen practice. You know, if you read the Pali Sutras, they're so nicely laid out. So, you know, the Pali Sutra says, you know, the Pali Sutras has these stages of mental cultivation called jhanas, the jhanas. And, you know, it says, when the Buddha meditated, he entered the first jhana, which is, you know, enjoying seclusion. And then you enter the second jhana, which is, you know, a feeling of physical well-being. And then you enter the next jhana. And there's four jhanas. They're called the jhanas of form. And then there's four formless jhanas, you know. And, you know, basically, once you are entering the formless jhanas, you enter emptiness, right? And then you enter, like, time disappears, then space disappears, then consciousness of consciousness disappears, right? So it's all neatly mapped out, and it never happens like that. Right? Those are idealizations of what should happen. You know, when you sit down on the cushion, at first you might go straight into emptiness. And then you come out of emptiness and your legs hurt. So it's like you went into the first formless jhana, and then you came out and you're not even in the first jhana. You're in an ordinary consciousness, right? And then you occasionally slip into the second jhana and so on. So it's not the idealized situation. So, you know, one way to react to all this is to just feel like you're a Zen failure. I'm a Buddhist failure. My meditation isn't working. And that's actually a fairly common attitude among people who have practiced for a while. And they lose faith. They would say, I've met people who practice for 6 or 7 years, and they say, you know, I just got nowhere. I got no, and I just stopped. You know, I just realized I'm not going to ever have enlightenment. You know, I'm going to take up tennis or something. But, you know, see what really happens is that they misunderstood the path, and they lost faith in their true nature, in their true nature. See, what Rinzai says is, you know, there's a person going in and out of your face. The person of truth, he said, is that is the Buddha himself, right? That's the Buddha himself. It's not just it's not just a problem with Zen practice, right? I mean, when I got out of college, I was determined to write a novel, right? And I actually worked for a year to save the money to write a novel. And I had everything all planned out, you know. I had this fantasy that I was going to sit down in this year of time and write this beautiful novel and send it to a book agent, and I would become like Cormac McCarthy, this famous writer who sent this manuscript to a book agent and, you know, has won the Pulitzer Prize several times, you know. And all of that went wrong, and I became so discouraged, you know, that I stopped writing altogether for a couple of years. See, here's another example of what I'm getting at that's maybe more appropriate. You know, there was a woman named Kennett. Her Dharma name is G.U. Kennett. And she was an English woman who was the first ordained woman in the Anglican Church. So she was a very brilliant and dynamic person. And she was at this time in her life an Anglican, a Protestant, English Protestant. And there were no women ordained women, no ministers priests in the Anglican Church at this time, and she wanted to break that barrier. So she actually went to the seminary, and she fought it out with everybody, and she eventually became the first woman ordained Anglican priest. And then she started reading books on Buddhism, and she became really interested in Buddhism, so much so that she sort of abandoned her faith in Anglicanism, and she went to Japan looking for a teacher who would accept a Westerner and a woman. And she finally found this teacher who would accept a Western woman, and she trained like a monk. She was the only woman in the temple. She was the only white person in the temple, and basically, all of these monks were, first of all, you know, Japanese people have many positive aspects, but they're very deeply sexist. And they wanted her to fail because she's a woman, number one. And they weren't very comfortable with this gaijin, this hakujin, this Caucasian training there either. And they all tried to trip her up and make her fail. They were all waiting for her to fall on her face. So, you know, basically, somebody would say, you had to get up at 4 in the morning, and somebody would say, don't worry, I'll wake you up at 4. And then, of course, the monk wouldn't wake her up at 4. She'd rush into the zendo when they're doing the sutras, and she'd feel totally like she'd been made a fool of. And this went on and on. And she went to see the teacher, who was a very good man, and she said, you know, I'm so discouraged. Everything I do wrong, and nobody's on my side. And the teacher said, everything is helping you wake up. Everything is helping you wake up. And this transformed her. She finished her training. She had a great awakening. She finished her training. I think that the essence of the Rinzai Zen is that everything is helping us wake up. And what is helping us wake up? You can say, who's doing that? Your big mind is helping you wake up at all times. Everything that happens is your big mind trying to help you wake up. Is everything in your life, it sounds like a fairy story, but everything in our mind, our big mind, is constantly leading us to enlightenment. This is the essence of Rinzai Zen. So the essence of Rinzai Zen is trusting the process, right? Trusting the process. And, you know, we don't trust the process. So you know, if the teacher tells you to watch the breath, and you have this experience where you fight your thoughts, and you fight your thoughts, and you fight your thoughts, and then you have a moment where you unify yourself with your breath, and then it goes away and you're back with your thoughts, you know, the reaction immediately is to think, I have failed, right? I've failed. You might go into the teacher and say, yes, you know, I had an experience where I was totally thoughtless and became one with my breath. And the teacher might say, that's wonderful. And you probably won't have said to the teacher, oh, but it all stopped and I went back into my thoughts. Or maybe you did. And maybe you feel like this is a big failure. But actually, you know, to hold on to the mind that is one with the breath, to hold on to that is not enlightenment. You're actually creating a barrier for yourself. So when you're working to cut through your thoughts and you have this moment of connection or unification with the breath and it goes away, that's not a mistake. It's not a failure. You're learning something more about reality, about your mind. Right? You're not ready maybe to understand what's happening, but what's happening is exactly what should be happening. No human being can maintain mindfulness of breath indefinitely. That would be impossible. The mind is constantly changing. The mind is a dynamic system. And it enters one state, and then it flips into another state. It's like constantly happening in this way. So you know, if you're a beginner on the path, your imaginary accomplishment is going to be that you're going to sit down on the cushion, become one with your breath, and be serene, and you will be eternally serene, or should be. But actually, serenity, too, is something you shouldn't cling to. You know, it's like happiness is something you shouldn't cling to. The mind is this dynamic system. It's constantly changing. And, you know, the essence of practice is not to fight it, but to be present with it. It's like trusting the process. You know, this happens all the time with koan training. So people will, I'll give somebody a koan and they're expecting a certain kind of response. And, you know, I'll say, here's your koan. If you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. And they're waiting for some kind of a stereotypical breakthrough experience. Maybe they're waiting to have, like, light fill their head or their, but, you know, they'll often come in and I'll say, what's happening on the cushion? And they'll say, nothing. And then I can say, well, tell me about just the nothing that's happening. You know, they'll start talking to me about what's actually happening. They'll say, well, I'm not able to focus on the koan. I keep thinking about my father. I keep thinking about the way he looked when I saw him the last time he was alive. I feel all this guilt. That, you know, in other words, the mind is responding to the koan, but not in the ways they expect. And they're, instead of following the process, trusting the process, they're trying to go in the direction they imagine they should go. And that's part of Zen training, right? We start every koan hoping to have the answer we think we should have. And with every koan, we go through this process of getting totally lost and feeling completely unable to predict what's going to happen next. And that's when we have a breakthrough. that's when we have a breakthrough. So you know, a breakthrough is when that resistance to this dynamic system, which is the mind, temporarily goes away, right? And we're able to be comfortable sort of following the mind on its path and trusting the mind enough to let it take us towards awakening. But, you know, it's very hard. You know, somebody like Linji, somebody like Rinzai, was a really remarkable person. But, you know, he lived in trust, you know, really lived in trust. And somebody like you know, these Zen masters, you could say, well, what made them Zen masters? Was it their ability to sit for hours without moving? And the answer is no. Was it their ability to hold their minds motionless for hours on end? No. Was it their ability to respond instantly to any event? No. It was their trust. You're trusting the process. Everything is helping you wake up. See, everything is helping. You know, when I was in the seventh grade, I had to take algebra, and I was terrified of algebra. I could not understand it. I had done pretty well in math, but when I got to algebra, you know, I literally just. Nobody in my family had ever gotten beyond math, basically. And, you know, the idea like 2a plus 4 is 12. It's like, how could I possibly know the answer to that? A is a letter, right? You know, I couldn't figure this out. It was just like, and I would, you know, I would fail every test, and I would come, my father would say, you just must study this. And I could not understand that A was symbolized. I know it sounds ridiculous, but I could not understand that A was symbolizing an unknown integer, right? You know, just I could not, and I would go in and I would just have this panic attack. So, you know, actually, everything is helping you wake up. You know, that, in some way, that event was helping me wake up. You know, it's like I had a wonderful teacher, algebra teacher, and I said, please move me into the shop math class. You know, if you gave up on the college trajectory, they would move you into they would assume you were going to be a carpenter or a bricklayer, and you'd take shop math, and you'd learn how to build stairs and things like that. And I said, just put me in the shop math class. And my teacher said, I'm not going to let you do that. And I don't know if she really helped me by the way she taught, but she just had so much confidence in me, you know? She had so much confidence in me, and I couldn't resist her confidence in me, you know? So I finally just started sitting at home and just working through these math. I started answering these algebra questions, you know? I would find the solution. I'd find A is 5 or something like that, and then I'd go on to the next one, and I would struggle, and I remember I failed every test the first half of the year, and then I got an A on every test in the second half of the year. In fact, sometimes I would do the test twice. I got so fast. I could do it once and then just do it twice in the allotted time. And what made the difference was that you know, trusting the process. You know, it wasn't really about the math. It was about not trusting myself. And her trust in me was really what made me persist, right? So if you start from the standpoint that enlightenment is very far away from you and almost impossible to reach, and that you are this hopelessly unenlightened person, you've sort of made sure that you are not going to you know, follow the path. But we all sort of start there, right? We all sort of start, I could never be like Lin Ji, I could never be like the Buddha, you know. But, you know, the Buddha started out just like you and I, you know, his legs hurt, he didn't know what he was doing. But, you know, I think he became the Buddha because he learned how to just trust the process, And you know, we're always evaluating our performance, and that's really something we should try never to do, right? You should try never to do. Just, it would be a good thing if every time you feel like you're not succeeding, you just said, everything is helping me wake up. Everything is helping me wake up. You know, I couldn't answer when my teacher gave me the breath perception koan, watch your breath. You know, I was so determined to answer that question, and I couldn't answer it. You know, I tried everything to answer that. Just all I had to do was come into the teacher and say, when I watch my breath, my mind goes blank. I would have passed the koan. And maybe that happened to me, but you know what? I never noticed it because I was looking for the answer I expected. And so I was on that koan for 3 years. Everybody else had gone on to other koans long before I finally was moved away from watching my breath and given the new koan. But I realized in retrospect that helped me so much. You know, I really learned how to trust myself. Right? All that failure made my practice so deep. Right? You know, it made my practice so. After that, nothing could really shake. Nothing would shake me. Nothing could discourage me anymore. You know, I had failed the koan so many times. It's like, well, why am I still here? And I realized I don't care why I'm here. Something inside me is drawing me forward. There's something, you know, there was something motivating me. Something, I had an energy I had to follow, even though the road ahead seemed to be littered with failures. Right? And that, I think, is what Zen practice is all about. Is, you know. You could fail every koan, but if you could pass every koan, and if you aren't in touch with that energy, it's like, I must do this. As I said, I went through this crisis where all of these people I was started practicing with were, they'd go to Sesshin, they'd come home, and they were all smiling, they'd all answered their koans. And it was like, everybody was going off to graduate school, and I was in this kindergarten still. But, you know, I found that even though that was true, there was a kind of energy that I didn't want to let go of. It was like, even if I don't answer a single koan, I'm going to trust that energy, you know. And I would say that's what Joe Joza has not learned to do, right? He's not, this day, the day of this story, is the day he realized, whether I ever become awakened or not, I am going to trust this energy. It's like something inside you says, get up on a Saturday and go to sit. And, you know, you listened to that and you came here. Something inside you says, go to Sesshin. And you listen to that. You know, and I've gone to Sesshin where I didn't answer the koan. You know, I was so sure I was going to, and I'd come home so bummed out. Right? But that's small mind thinking, right? It's whether you answer the koan or not, you know, if you become the servant of that energy, you know, you are on the path to enlightenment. You're on the path. In fact, trusting that energy is like enlightenment itself, actually. Engo's introduction. Once the delusive way of thinking is cut off, you know, answering or not answering, making progress or not making progress. Those are all that have nothing to do with your intimate relationship with that energy. 1,000 eyes are suddenly opened. One word blocking the stream of thought and all Nen actions are controlled. Is there anyone who would undergo the experience of dying the same death and living the same life as the Buddha? Trust is manifest everywhere. You know, trust has nothing to do with success or failure. It has nothing to do with answering or not answering your koan. You know, it's the energy that is it's the energy that arises spontaneously that brings you to the cushion, that brings you to sashin. And if you trust that, the rest, nothing else really matters in life. Okay, and he says, if you don't know about this, here's a story. Main subject. Joe Joza asked Rinzai, what is the essence of Buddhism? See, I'm a 70-year-old man and I haven't had Daikensho. You know, where did I go wrong? And Rinzai, getting up from his seat, seized him, slapped him, and pushed him away. Elder Joe stood still, a monk standing by said, Joe Joza, why don't you bow? And at that moment, Joe Joza discovers that energy. It doesn't matter. He discovers that it's that your intimate relationship to the energy that made you come here today, that told you to come here today, and you listen to that energy. That's what this is all about. When Joe Joza bowed, he suddenly became enlightened. Secho's verse, inheriting the spirit of Dansai, how could he be gentle and quiet? Not difficult for Kyore to lift his hands and split Mount Kasan, letting the Yellow River through. These are like mythical beings, right, who can command rivers and split mountains. But you know, if you trust that energy, you are those beings.